forced to hear about what you dislike in men. So, for example, it might be okay in limited doses to say things like, "I feel really hurt when your grandfather gets so quiet and distant." Or, "I don't understand these bodybuilding magazines. Don't guys get how great they look just the way they are?" But it simply is not acceptable, and again can be seriously detrimental to a boy's development, if he hears you making negative remarks about the men closest to him. "Your father is such a jerk, the way he acts like such a know-it-all." Or, "Your older brother thinks he's Hercules. I wish he'd stop spending so much time lifting weights and just get over himself." Or more subtle things, such as, "Does your friend John think he's cool with those silly unlaced shoes?" Or, "Those flowers your father bought me are not going to make up for the fact that he always comes home so late from work." All of these negative messages about men only obscure what you really want for your boy. So avoid them as best you can. Rotate parenting responsibilities. If you're in a two-parent family, rotate the tasks of parenting with your partner. For instance, don't always make your husband the disciplinarian, and don't allow yourself to be the only one whose job it is to nurture your boys when they're feeling down. When each parent shares the tasks of parenting in a gender-neutral way, it gives a boy the message that being empathic and nurturing is not just a woman's job, and that being strict and tough is not only for men. The way that we divide our responsibilities as parents really does give boys powerful messages about gender roles and masculinity. Just think, if we're telling our boys that they should be more gentle and sensitive, but then relegating all of the sensitivity training to mom, it's no wonder that our sons will begin to internalize a sense that this is a purely female agenda. By contrast, if dad too is pitching in on the empathy training, and if mom takes on some of the roles and responsibilities traditionally assumed by dad, naturally the boy will become more flexible and feel far more confident about his male identity. When your son is hurting, don't hesitate to ask him whether he'd like to talk. Even though your son may not respond right away, there's nothing wrong with asking him how things are going and whether he'd like to talk to you. Simply engaging him in a frank conversation is often effective in helping him work through difficult feelings. Sometimes it works well to initiate this somewhat subtly. For instance, rather than saying, "Gee, you seem like you're in a terrible mood. Do you want to talk about how you're feeling?" You might instead say something like, "Hey, we haven't hung out and talked about things for a while. Do you feel like spending some time together this afternoon?" Especially by focusing away from your son as the one with problems and gently suggesting some time together for intimate sharing, at the very least you're showing that you care, that you're interested in connecting with him. Depending on his particular personality and the feelings he's experiencing at the time, he may accept your offer, or perhaps tell you he's uninterested or unavailable, or that he needs some time alone. The key here is to wait until he's ready to talk with you. But avoid shaming your boy if he refuses to talk with you. If your boy indicates he's not interested in talking with you right away, try to avoid saying or doing anything that might shame him for his refusal. Saying things like, "Oh, you're just like your father," or, "If you knew what's best for you, you'd sit right down and talk to me now," are both examples of typical shaming statements. Slamming the door behind you or walking off in a huff are behaviors that give your boy the same kind of message. In reality, there's nothing wrong with his need for some time on his own. It may be his best way of coping with difficult feelings, or it may just be the way he thinks the boy code expects him to behave. As much as you may feel rejected or eager to help him, try to avoid punishing him for his decision to spend time alone. Instead, simply let him know that you love him, that it's all right if he doesn't want to talk right away, and that you'll be there for him if he wants to talk later. Honor your son's need for timed silence. If your son prefers not to talk right away, give him the chance to spend some time on his own. He may get into a quiet mood, sit down in front of the television, listen to music, or go off to be by himself. Do not interrupt him right away. As in almost every other case, he'll come out from his place of isolation and seek out some attention. When your boy seeks reconnection, try your best to be there for him. It's important to make yourself available when your boy finally emerges from his self-imposed period of silence and isolation. He may not provide you with a long window of connection, so it's best that you pay close attention to him and try to notice when he's reaching out for you. It may be subtle. He may simply ask you, "What time are we having dinner?" Or it may be explicit. "Mom, can we talk now?" In either case, your best response is to let him know, without embarrassing him, that you'd be happy to spend time with him. Experiment with connection through action. When you first approach your boy, or when he approaches you following a timed silence, you may find it helpful to try to connect with him through action-oriented activities. Thus, instead of encouraging him to talk with you right away, invite him to do something active with you. Whether it's taking care of a chore, playing a sport, or going for a walk, doing something together can often provide subsequent opportunities for talking together. Not only is this a good way to reconnect with many boys, it also gives them another message that you understand their style of relating, that you respect it, and that you're eager to experience it together. Don't hold back. Finally, and most important, don't feel you need to hold back. It's fine to show your son your love and affection. It will only make him feel stronger and more capable of handling the outside world. While we've spoken of the problems that can arise if any parent is too dependent, controlling, or domineering, the psychological literature overemphasizes the frequency of this kind of parent. My years of working with boys and their parents suggest that moms need not worry. Their love is tremendously valuable, and it truly helps boys become confident, powerful, successful men. The power of mothers. In many ways, Western society has traditionally celebrated the powerful connections that develop between mother and son. For instance, Freud, whose later followers often distorted many of his brilliant insights, recognized the positive power of mothers, the potency of maternal connection. As he put it, "If a man has been his mother's undisputed darling, he retains throughout life the triumphant feeling, the confidence in his success, which not seldom brings actual success with it." In past centuries, sons were indeed expected to remain closer to their mothers. According to historian Anthony Rotundo, mothers were encouraged to maintain intimate ties with sons for as long as they lived, and were expected to shape their son's moral character. Today we have somehow lost touch with this wisdom, with the reality that mothers can and do have such a profound positive impact on the emotional lives of boys, an impact that lasts a lifetime. Mothers have an awesome power to allay the shame-based hardening process that too often claims the psychological souls of our boys, and they model and influence their sons to give vent to vulnerable emotions, such as sadness, fear, and anxiety. I strongly believe that both a boy's ongoing natural yearning for his mother's love and the mother's deep-seated desire to continue loving her son should be permitted to find appropriate expression. Mothers should feel free to follow what they have always known in their hearts to be the truth, that when he maintains an ongoing connection to his mom, a boy is taking an important, healthy step toward becoming a man. As we've seen, a mother is often an expert at coaxing a boy to be more emotionally expressive, feel more confident about himself, and reveal his complete personality with more courage and honesty. But she's also especially talented at showing how boys can merge these new, sensitive qualities with some of the traditional qualities celebrated as typically masculine. By giving her son the love and support he needs to satisfy society's two-sided rules about masculinity, while still being the person he truly is, a mother is training him to become a man who can share his feelings in an authentic way, a man who can be forthright about what he likes and doesn't like, a man who's able to share his genuine self with friends, family, and colleagues alike. By connecting closely with her son, she's giving him the energy, confidence, and savvy he needs to meet all of society's expectations of him, old and new, while still honoring his true self, the real boy behind the mask. Chapter 6. Real Fathers, Real Men. The Empathic Relationships of Fathers and Sons. I've got a couple of pretty good friends who I can count on for some of the small things. But when something big comes up, or I'm feeling really down, I go to the one guy who really understands and who can really help. And that's my dad. Tyler Williams, age 12. The Special Role of Fathers. Fathers are not male mothers. Interactions between father and son are, as we know, crucially important in a boy's life. But they don't always look the same as those between mother and son. Fathers tend to develop their own loving style of teaching, guiding, and playing with their boys. Enthrallment. Father-son play. Beginning very early in the lives of boys, fathers show a special ability to enliven and broaden their sons' play activities and to teach their sons how to feel and express certain emotions. Research shows that while mothers tend to soothe their children and shield them from too much stimulation, the average father is inclined to arouse the emotions and stimulate a boy, playing with him zestfully and jazzing him up. In studies observing interactions between fathers and babies, Professor Ross Park at the University of California's Riverside Center for Family Studies discovered that dads are just as responsive to infant cues as mothers are, although their style with their sons is remarkably different. Park found that when fathers spend intimate recreational time with baby boys, the fathers show a unique capacity to draw out the infant's emotional expression along a wider scale of intensity, and to help the infants to learn how to tolerate a wide range of people and social situations. When their sons become toddlers, fathers boost the stimulation ante, revving up the emotional systems of their sons by playing games such as tag or wrestling. Martin Greenberg, a child psychiatrist, referred to a father's early emotional investment in his newborn as engrossment. I call active father-son play enthrallment, since in my experience a boy becomes enthralled by the loving, playful attention of his father, and dad becomes enthralled by the responses of his son. This gift that fathers have, this enhanced ability to evoke a son's diverse emotional responses, is invaluable to boys. With the help of their dads, boys can learn how to engage in a broad range of appropriately spirited behaviors. In fact, when fathers take the time to play zestfully with boys during their infancy and as youngsters, at adolescence, these children often need less guidance from adults when handling difficult feelings, and are more capable of handling emotionally intense situations in a graceful and socially acceptable way. The benefits of father-son enthrallment. Learning how to read another's emotions. While perhaps some of this fatherly rough-and-tumble play, what Harvard psychiatrist Jim Herzog calls kamikaze play, drives mothers up the wall, research shows that such father play or enthrallment has many developmental benefits because it forces children, and this is especially significant for young boys, to learn to regulate and tolerate their feelings when interacting with a different special caregiver, to identify these feelings more clearly, and to adapt to a variety of complex social situations. How does this learning occur? A father's playful and vigorous type of play forces a boy to learn to read his father's emotions. Is dad joking, or is he seriously in the mood to roughhouse? A boy might ask himself, closely observing his father's facial expressions and body language to figure out his father's mood. Then, too, by playing with his father, a boy is prodded to learn how to communicate his own fluctuating emotional states to adults and to other children. Is this roughhousing going too far for me? He may ask himself. If so, the boy may begin to cry. Is this getting boring? He might ask instead. If so, the boy may withdraw to signal that he needs more stimulation. And perhaps most important, through interactions with father, a boy learns to listen to his own inner emotional states, identifying which ones are overwhelming, out of control, tolerable, or intolerable. Emotional management. Dad play, then, leads to important emotional mastery skills. As a father coaxes a son to cope with interactions that test his limits and stretch him emotionally, the boy starts to feel empowered to effect change in his environment by analyzing what he is feeling and then communicating these feelings to his parents and others. As 9-year-old Bradley, a boy in my recent study, explained, "My dad and I play rough and horse around, and sometimes we wrestle, and then one of us has to give up, has to stop. Sometimes it's me, and sometimes I'll be laughing, and sometimes I'll be crying. But it's good, because then at school I'm not afraid of anybody or anything, and I know when I'm going too far." These early father-son lessons in emotion management can actually be of lifelong importance. They have been linked to later capacities in the boy to manage frustrations, explore novel circumstances, and persevere in academic problem-solving. Even more important, they have been tied, by Ross Park and others, to the ability older boys have to master social encounters and to better handle interpersonal strife with communication skills and cooperation rather than with fighting. To put it simply, that roughhousing between father and son that may make mom cringe is actually the rudimentary beginning of a boy's management of his aggression and his ability to substitute emotional mastery and mutual cooperation for violent interaction. As Jay Belsky at Penn State University, a pioneer researcher on the impact fathers have on their children, has quipped, "If Adam had been a better father, things would have turned out differently for Cain and Abel." Fathers and Sons, Empathic Relationships. In addition to teaching critical emotional management skills, fathers, through the warm, playful, empathic relationships they forge with their sons, imbue boys with an important sense of safety and well-being that bolsters a boy's feelings of masculine self-confidence. As 12-year-old Jackson told me, "I have to go to these extra help reading classes at school on Saturdays. I don't think I need those stupid classes, but when my dad drives me there and waits until I'm done, I really don't mind going as much." Or as 7-year-old Tommy explained, "I like it best when my dad comes to my Little League games because he cheers for me, and then I feel like I've hit a home run, even if I strike out." Feeling empathy for a child, studies show, seems to come naturally to most dads. Though they may express it differently than mothers do, studies show that many fathers feel deep empathy for their sons and want to stay closely connected to them. This was not always believed to be the case. For instance, in early studies that measured how fathers and mothers reacted when a baby began to cry, mothers seemed more sensitive and caring than fathers did in how they responded to the crying infant. But in recent studies that look at biological rather than behavioral markers of empathic response, factors such as heart rate and rhythm, changes in blood pressure, skin responsivity, and so on, researchers have found that when responding to the urgent cries of a young infant, there are no differences between how men and women react. Though women may behave on the outside as though they are more thoughtful and concerned about their baby's feelings than men are, or at least may be perceived by researchers in this way, in reality, both men and women have a full range of biologically based empathic reactions toward their sons. Because of the way we as a society view boys and men when they act in a way that is open, caring, or expressive, many fathers, especially in public settings, may feel inhibited about showing the empathy they naturally feel for their sons. So, on the surface, it may seem as though fathers just can't be as close to their sons as mothers often are. Yet, in my 20 years of work with fathers and sons, what is most striking is the genuine and profound feeling that boys and fathers have for each other throughout their lives. I believe that boys and their fathers both feel immense natural empathy for one another and yearn to develop closer, more connected relationships. As 12-year-old Marco expressed it, "I like going to school every day, but what I love the most is going to my house, doing my homework with my mom, and then I wait for my father to come home. When my dad walks in the door, it's always a really special feeling." Jack, a father in one of my studies, put it this way, "When my boss makes me stay late at work, I just hate it. I can't stand the feeling of missing out on one extra moment of seeing my son, on being able to go home to play with him, and then see that special glimmer in his eye when I tuck him into bed." Or as 12-year-old Tyler Williams said when asked to describe whom he turns to when he's feeling unhappy, "I've got a couple of pretty good friends who I can count on for some of the small things. But when something big comes up or I'm feeling really down, I go to the one guy who really understands and who can really help. And that's my dad." Just as boys yearn for the special kind of companionship and nurturing that many fathers provide, Their fathers, in turn, long for the chance to coach and educate their sons, participate closely in their emotional lives, and, through intimate connection with their boys, perhaps achieve the loving responsiveness that they may have lacked in their earlier relationships with their own fathers. Within our current social and family contexts, however, for a variety of reasons, these natural mutual longings sometimes remain unfulfilled or only partially satisfied. Yet my research shows that many fathers and sons are discovering new ways to forge close, active, caring relationships. Here I am, the generative father. Fathers have a natural ability, as mothers do, to be what Erik Erikson, the well-known psychoanalyst, called generative. The generative father is one who cares a lot about the next generation, who wants to help guide his children and give them what they need to be productive, creative, and happy. The generative father enjoys being needed by his children and thrives on giving them what they require. Although some fathers may focus their generative impulses more traditionally toward working hard and striving for financial and professional success for the family, many fathers also apply their generative efforts toward developing close, attached, deeply loving relationships with their daughters and sons. When I think about the importance of fathers and the emotional connections they can share with their sons, I recall the biblical father-son pair of Abraham and his firstborn son, Isaac. Coming late in Abraham's life, through the intercession of Sarah's prayers to God, Isaac represents a much-loved and special son, the inheritor of all the future promises to the Hebrews, and the beginning of a paternal line that leads from the Old Testament into the Christian world of the New. Although the story is still read today as testimony to a man's faith in his God, as reflecting the monotheistic ethic of ending human sacrifice on behalf of God, it also could symbolize the bonds between fathers and their sons. While Abraham's love for Isaac was tested by God, in the end Abraham and Isaac, father and son, were reunited in a profound and meaningful way. The story of Abraham and Isaac is most clearly centered on God's command to Abraham to bring Isaac, his only son, to be sacrificed. God calls upon Abraham to have his son killed, presumably to test Abraham's faith in his newfound God. In the original Hebrew rendition of the tale, the story is called The Binding of Isaac, referring to Isaac's attachment to the sacrificial pyre prior to the angel's intervention and the substitution of an animal by God in order to save the father from such an intolerable loss. A beautiful poetic phrase used repeatedly in the ancient Hebrew text when God calls upon Abraham to be his spiritual son is the reply, Hineni, here I am. On another level, Abraham, more than just responding to God, is announcing to Isaac, his one and only son, Hineni, here I am. And perhaps today, in quite a similar way, most fathers are trying to let their sons know that they are there, ready to love, comfort, and protect them. And recent statistics reflect that's what fathers want. In a large poll recently conducted by Newsweek magazine, 55% of men interviewed felt that parenting was more significant to them than it had been to their own fathers. And while over 60% felt they did it better than their dads, 20% said their fathers did it much better. 70% said they spend more time with their children than their fathers did with them, and 86% of the mothers who shared parenting responsibilities with these men rated them as doing a good or very good job at parenting. As these findings indicate, not only do most fathers today want to be close to their sons, they are close to them. Fathers also seem to feel more confident about these emotional bonds and to have the support of their wives in making them. My research shows that now more than ever before, contemporary fathers are putting aside old ways of passive fathering, turning with confidence toward their sons, and crying out loudly and clearly, "Hineni, here I am." This is the pronouncement of the generative father, the father who rejoices in the need he shares with his son for love and connection. The lasting daddy effect. A boy whose father stays close to him during infancy and early childhood benefits from this fundamental father-son connection for a lifetime. Studies show that a father's empathy and his involvement with his son at early stages pays off all through a boy's life, especially during the turbulent years of adolescence. We know from the work of Leslie Brody at Boston University, for example, that when fathers are actively involved in their sons' lives, the boys turn out to be less aggressive, less overly competitive, and better able to express feelings of vulnerability and sadness. Brody's research suggests that boys with active, caring fathers don't feel the need to act out or show aggression in order to win their father's love and attention. It also suggests that boys with such fathers observe how their dads handle various life situations and thus learn how to deal with such situations thoughtfully and appropriately. Hardesty and her research group at Morehead State University in Kentucky corroborated these findings with a sample of boys followed from ages 7 through 22. Fathers who were close and nurturing had adolescent boys who had more flexible attitudes about gender and life. First-grade boys whose fathers participated in their care showed greater capacity for empathy in a study conducted at Santa Clara University. And in a study of preschool children and their fathers in Alabama, fathers who were closely involved in the nurturing of their children were shown to have sons with increased self-esteem and low incidence of depression. The profound and lasting impact of fathers upon their sons' emotional lives has also been demonstrated by several longitudinal studies, studies conducted with the same group of boys and men over decades. In work done by Robert Sears, young men who at the age of 23 were best able to compromise to resolve conflicts were the ones whose fathers were most sharing in their care at the age of 5. As adults, this group of the well-fathered boys also showed the effects of their father's early parenting when their capacity for empathy was assessed at age 31 and the health of their social relationships and capacity for intimacy was evaluated in their 40s. Along similar lines, the Gluck study, first undertaken over 4 decades ago with 240 fathers and their sons in the Boston area, and later followed by John Snary at Harvard, demonstrated that fathers who were supportive of their sons' social and emotional development during their sons' first 10 years of life had boys who excelled in high school and college. And when fathers kept up this nurturing through adolescence, their son's career success was also influenced positively. Indeed, it was virtually impossible for fathers to be too involved with their sons, barring any overt misuse of the time together. The more time the fathers stayed close to their boys, the better the boys did. A different way of relating, love through action. Because in the past, relatively few men had fathers who participated actively in their day-to-day emotional development as children, it is hard for many of them to know exactly how to initiate a close relationship with their own sons. Many fathers I talk to feel passionately about getting involved with their sons, but wonder about the best way to get started. They feel love and empathy for them, but feel nervous or unsure about how to convey these feelings. But fathers, and as we've discussed, this is often true for mothers too, are often most effective when they simply join in their son's activities. Whether the son is hammering a nail, cleaning a very dirty car, or printing and collating multiple sections of an overdue term paper, many boys enjoy the feeling of doing something requiring a good deal of energy, working hard or accomplishing a difficult task, with the help and support of their fathers. Fathers, I have found, often discover they can most effectively tap into boys' emotional worlds by joining their sons in this kind of work-related, goal-oriented activity, or supporting them in their efforts. Because our society places tremendous emphasis on the conventional female approach of bonding verbally by sharing feelings through words, we often lose sight of what my research illuminates, that fathers frequently show that they care and nurture their sons through action. Young boys, for instance, love the intimate sharing and camaraderie in helping dad to change a younger sibling's diaper, going outside and throwing a football, shopping together for a saxophone, and so on. Older boys enjoy being together with their fathers, for instance, on a long bike ride, at a movie, or on a Sunday morning mission to prepare a surprise soup-to-nuts brunch for the whole family. The specific activity does not matter so much as the connection that develops through sharing in an action together. While words and emotions may be exchanged openly, many times it's just being at the same time at the same place, and doing some activity together that help father and son grow close to one another. The action-oriented language of fatherly love. Especially during the stormy period of boys' adolescence, a dad's capacity to hang in with his son and remain active in a boy's daily activities makes all the difference. In an 11-year study that followed boys beginning at ages 7 to 11 through ages 18 to 22, the more shared activities a boy had with his father, the more education he completed. And the closer the emotional bond between father and son, the lower was the incidence of social delinquency. Indeed, this study showed that fathers had more of an effect on their teenage sons in their academic and social functioning than mothers did. And boys reported receiving greater emotional support from fathers than mothers in well-functioning two-parent families. By contrast, when D'Angelo and colleagues at Case Western Reserve studied over 80 adolescent boys, they found that boys with fathers who had the poorest self-control, boys with fathers who easily lost their tempers or who frequently acted out in impulsive ways, demonstrated significant difficulties in almost all areas of their lives. These boys had problems doing well at school or showing up to school, were poor at resolving conflicts in an appropriate way, and found it difficult to get along with their peers. They also tended to have problems with drugs and alcohol, were relatively inept at handling intimate relationships, and tended to be sexually promiscuous. Fathers provide a flexible surface for their sons to bounce off, a play space with elastic but firm limits, a secure sense of love expressed not just in words, but through actions. When they refrain from disciplining their sons in heavy-handed ways and from emotionally overreacting to the inevitable provocations boys use to test their emerging masculinity, fathers can neutralize their sons' rebelliousness and teach boys, and often mothers too, an action-oriented language of fatherly love. A bright and sassy 13-year-old has a prickly debate with his father, A 15-year-old argues about curfew. A 17-year-old tears through the house yelling and screaming about his girlfriend and cursing under his breath. Before all hell breaks loose for any of these boys, his dad grabs him up and says, "Hey, let's go out back and shoot some baskets." To all of this potential aggression spinning out of control, the involved and nurturing dad will provide a loving, holding environment. He will good-naturedly maintain reasonable expectations and express his love through action. Boys and Nonverbal Love. In addition to doing things together with his son, with genuine camaraderie, a father can also convey his love by doing things for his son through nonverbal gestures. As Jerome, a 49-year-old African-American man and the father of two boys, reminisced about his own father, "We never really said much at all, because my father was never much of a talker. It was what he did that mattered. I remember that when I was younger, sometimes I'd get all balled up about something, really unable to do anything but go to my room and cry. Soon after my retreat, I'd hear a knock on the door and I'd know it was Dad. 'What would your dad say when he came in to see you?' I asked. 'He wouldn't say anything,' Jerome offered. 'Without saying a word, he'd just slide up beside me on the bed and begin to gently rub my back. It was a firm, soothing sense, like he knew I was hurting. Neither one of us had to say much. I'm not sure we could have, really. But I knew my dad was there for me, that he cared. But Dad is dead now. He died of cancer when I was 15. When I think of him, though, I always remember those back rubs. He didn't have to say, "I love you." Somehow I just always knew it." I was touched by Jerome's story and told him I could understand why the back rubs were so memorable for him. He then began to tell me about his experiences as a soldier during the Vietnam War. Jerome was in the thick of the fighting, and the patrols would go out on overnight missions, digging foxholes and lying in them two or three soldiers at a time, waiting to ambush the enemy. The waiting time was excruciating, the tension unbearable, and the men had to stay relatively silent so as not to attract enemy fire. Since Jerome and his buddies couldn't talk, all they could do to support each other and relieve the pain was to give one another back rubs. This imbued Jerome with a sense of fraternal love and safety he hadn't felt for years. Today, when his own boys have had a hard day or gotten into an adolescent tiff about power and control, he'll often wait until evening, knock softly on their door, and ask if they'd like him to rub their backs. He says, "They've never said no." Tag team parenting, the father's role in supporting the mother. Fathers also strengthen their relationships with their sons indirectly by supporting the children's relationships with their mothers. Indeed, an important component of effective fathering is the ability to weave comfortably in and out of his son's relationship with the mother. It is that important skill of knowing whether, if, for example, an argument is about to break out, one should quietly intercede, helping both mother and son, or whether one should give them space to work things out without their feeling crowded. It is also about recognizing the need, when father and son have just about had it with each other, to bow out gracefully and give mom a turn at finding a resolution, something a colleague once called tag-team parenting, after those wrestling matches which co-parenting a boy may often bring to mind. Mothers and fathers need to leave their gender-based fortresses and develop mutually acceptable arrangements to parent their sons. It's just as essential that fathers spend some of their time supporting their wives and children by being physically and emotionally present as it is that their wives facilitate their husbands learning how to take care of a newborn and how to parent a young child. Men need to accept that wives can mentor them in nurturing skills. At the same time, wives need to recognize that male ways of parenting can be a valuable complement to mothering. As discussed in the last chapter, mothers and women perform a central role in very young and teenage boys' adaptation to masculinity. But one of the most essential ingredients in mother-son bonding is the father's capacity to know when and how to intervene in his boy's relationship with the mother. Ideally, a father's involvement in rearing his adolescent son need not include imploring his son to stand on his own two feet, spurring him on to become an independent boy-man. Instead, fathers need to strike a balance between supporting the boy's growing sense of independence, his sense of the I, as well as the boy's continuing need for connection with both parents, the we aspect that is also a natural and important part of his maturing masculine self. While the boy should be encouraged to explore the bounds of autonomy, he must also be made to feel welcome to return to dad, as well as to mom, for love, support, and affection, to maintain his relational ties. Barriers to fatherhood. Beginning in early youth, when the premature push away from mother creates both a crisis and an opportunity for father and son, many well-meaning dads, even though they're eager to get involved in their young sons' lives, discover they are ill-equipped to supply the male mentoring that then becomes critical. The difficulty fathers have in embracing their young sons stems from a variety of factors, some internal, such as how confident a father feels about his abilities as a dad, and some external, such as how well mom deals with dad's attempts at fatherhood. Some of these factors are easy to overcome, some less easy. When dad's dad was absent, father hunger. First, many fathers find it difficult to become closely involved in parenting their sons because during their own upbringing they themselves lacked a father who sought this kind of closeness. "It's a hard thing being a dad," Stephen, one of the fathers in my study, told me, "because so often our own fathers weren't there in the way we wanted them to be, and there are so few role models." Reporting on male sexuality, the sociological researcher Cher Height found in her sample of more than 7,000 men that almost none of them could claim they were close to their fathers. Likewise, Jack Sternbach, a Massachusetts psychologist, recently found in an informal survey of 71 clients that almost one quarter had physically absent fathers. Another 40% had fathers who were psychologically or emotionally absent, and 15% had fathers they found frightening or dangerous. Such statistics are even more staggering when we look at the African-American population. Between 1970 and 1994, the percentage of black children living in single-parent families nearly doubled. And by 1994, 60% of black children lived in one-parent homes. Growing up without a father, or with an ineffectual father, inevitably leaves its mark. In recently conducted research, the majority of the men I studied consistently expressed that they wished to be a better father than their own fathers had been. What we may be hearing from fathers is an unrequited yearning that generations of men have experienced, what psychiatrist Jim Herzog has dubbed father hunger. But when men say that they wish to be better fathers to their own sons than their fathers had been to them, I believe they are not uttering mere rhetoric or trying to vicariously satisfy their own childhood hunger, but in fact expressing a genuine wish, a wish that is carried out at times against difficult odds. Father absence has been correctly linked to a host of ills for boys: diminished self-esteem, depression, delinquency, violence, crime, gang membership, academic failure, and difficulties with emotional commitments. But what this absence also does is provide boys with a warped model of parenting, one that teaches them that it's acceptable not to have a father who stays in the picture. Boys who are raised with this model, not surprisingly, may find it difficult when they become fathers to feel confident about being a parent. For such men, for men whose fathers were not there for them, it's important to take a few steps. First, these dads should spend time with other dads. This can happen informally by doing things with friends or with other families in the neighborhood, or by joining a father's group at a local school, church, synagogue, or social center. Just as many women go to discussion groups for support on work, parenting, and other issues, many fathers, especially new fathers or fathers whose own dads were either absent or not there for them, benefit enormously from sharing stories, ideas, and concerns with other fathers. In addition, dads should try their best to take cues from their wives. By observing how mom handles various situations with a boy, and translating her approach into his own dad version, a father can often find the confidence and know-how necessary to deal with situations when it's his turn to take the lead with his son. Not only does watching and modeling himself after mom's approach help make dad feel less anxious, it also provides her with a healthy dose of his loving affirmation and brings mom and dad closer in the process. What to do about the gatekeeping mother? Yet, as close as mother and father may become through mutual parenting, sometimes they can fall into patterns that draw them apart and actually make it tougher to feel good about themselves as parents. Some fathers may find it hard to stay closely involved in nurturing their sons if their wives engage in unconscious gatekeeping. As we discussed in the last chapter, gatekeeping is what happens when mothers, despite their very best intentions, unwittingly maintain so close a bond with their sons that there is simply little room left for the father to play a meaningful role. The emotional gate has been kept closed. It usually manifests itself in subtle ways, such as when the mother hands the baby to the father at an inopportune moment and says, "Oh, dear, don't hold him like that," or, "That isn't the way to rock him." Often the father, who is already feeling inadequate, unconsciously colludes by hastily giving his son back to his wife and backing off. The father's imagined or expected deficiencies lead him to feel shame and thus to shy away from subsequent connecting with his son. With men and women increasingly sharing one another's traditional turf and often sharing financial responsibilities, it is understandable that some women may feel inclined, often unconsciously, to maintain some control over the historically female-managed realms of household and day-to-day parenting. This may entail significant strain and sacrifice, particularly for career-oriented women who are already juggling the burdens of work and home. But it can also have the completely unintended and unfortunate effect of making fathers, especially those whose own fathers had not been terribly nurturing, feel afraid, incompetent, or unwelcome. The principal way around this mother-father dynamic is threefold. First, it's important for moms to try to separate those tasks that dads actually do need some coaching on from those that they know how to handle just fine. For instance, If a baby is being fed formula rather than being breastfed, a father may need to be instructed before he mixes the formula for the first time. But if the father has already learned this task and does it well, he probably does not need to be instructed again the next time he offers to feed the baby. The second helpful step is for moms and dads to share everything they know or are learning about these various tasks. If the doors of communication are wide open and the teaching happens in a mutual, positive, consistent way, both father and mother can learn new approaches without feeling as though the other is being patronizing or overcritical. Thus, instead of saying, "Honey, you're going to kill him if you burp him that way," the more competent parent might say in a more relaxed way, "Hey, honey, look at the neat way I figured out to burp him. It's really easy and seems to work just great." Finally, I think it's a good idea for each parent to give the other private time with the child so that each can feel more confident about his or her parenting styles and abilities. Thus, when it's time to feed the baby or to comfort him when he cries, sometimes it's best if just one parent takes charge and is allowed to handle the task alone without the presence of the other. When a dad is given this kind of one-on-one, learn-by-doing-it-yourself time, the problem of gatekeeping often evaporates as both father and mother come to fully trust themselves and each other. Another barrier to full fatherhood: fleeing into nest feathering. Just as some mothers engage in unintentional gatekeeping, many fathers engage in a parallel unconscious process occurring around the time of the birth of the newborn and continuing into the child's early years that I refer to as nest feathering. My research shows that new fathers often feel that the best way to be a parent is to be a competent breadwinner, to feather the nest, to work assiduously to earn greater income or career status, to create a comfortable home for his wife and son. But there can be a negative side to this approach. As one executive told me, "I think I actually run away to work sometimes. I know how to run a team and make a business plan, but diaper a baby or talk to my son about his feelings? His mother's so good at it, I feel like an oaf." While this kind of nest feathering may in fact be a natural instinct on the part of fathers, it seems to run directly against what most mothers wish would happen, and certainly against what a boy would want. Mothers report that what upsets them most during this period of a boy's early childhood is that fathers are emotionally absent. And in my interviews with fathers, most of them lament the fact that they don't get enough time to relate closely to their sons. It seems that many husbands sacrifice for their wives and their wives sacrifice for them in ways that do not reflect their true yearnings, in ways that seem terribly out of sync. The predicament of nest feathering can be solved through two avenues. First, it's important for father and mother to talk openly and regularly about their disappointments in each other. It's too late when mother complains about dad's emotional absence while in the car on the way to dropping off the boy for his freshman year of college. If mom and dad check in with each other on a consistent basis about how their co-parenting is going, speak honestly about how they should divide and share the responsibilities of parenthood, and about how well or poorly things are working out, it's far more difficult for father to engage exclusively in nest feathering, since any resentments he may feel about how hard he may be working, or any resentment she may feel about his absence, will likely be brought to the fore. Second, it's critical that both mother and father talk together to clarify their values about how hard they each want to work, what their career goals are, what their financial objectives may be, how important it is to each of them to spend quality time with their children, and so on. Many times it turns out that both parents, for instance, would happily forego the addition to the house or the new car if it meant they would each have more time to spend as a family. But if these value-clarifying discussions are not taking place, each parent may make separate, often self-defeating decisions, rather than coming to a new understanding based on their shared goals and aspirations. Dad may continue to work around the clock to pay for that new addition to the house. Mom may continue to watch the front door each night, wishing Dad would come home earlier and just be with the family, rather than worry about making the extra money. Simply by talking openly about what really matters to them, and coming up with approaches that fulfill what both of them want, mother and father can avoid the tragedy that can come from nest feathering. The myth of the macho father. In addition to succumbing to nest feathering, some fathers resist getting closely involved in nurturing their sons because of the myths about boys that we've already discussed. Many fathers fear that if they don't follow the old boy code by acting tough around their sons and by pushing their boys as early as possible to act strong and independent, their sons will become outcast sissies rather than real boys destined for success in the mainstream. Closely tied to this fear are father's own experiences of being a boy, a son. Research clearly shows that many men feel a wound when it comes to the memories of the fathering they received. These can be painful memories, and most men find that before they can work at becoming a new kind of father, they first need to address these memories head on. While some of this emotional work might be best done with the help of a qualified therapist or in the context of a father support group, fathers can often overcome the straitjacket of gender simply by consciously deciding to rebel against it. Consider, for example, the following story of Bill Sandberg, who, by looking honestly at his own internal demons and thinking creatively about how to conquer them, helped both his son and himself to escape society's rigid ideas about boys and masculinity, and in the process become closer as father and son. Bill had grown up in a family with an alcoholic father. When his father drank, he usually became quiet and reclusive, wanting little to do with Bill. On a couple of occasions, rarely as far as Bill can remember, his dad actually lashed out at him, mostly just by yelling loudly and uncontrollably, apparently once or twice taking a swing at him with a canoe paddle. In discussions with me as a friend, Bill shared how he still harbors a distinct memory of when, as a 16-year-old boy, he asked his parents whether he might be able to take a pottery course at the local community center, rather than playing soccer, as he usually did each fall. His father, perhaps worried about how other people might respond, not only forbade Bill from taking the course, but one evening after drinking, bombarded Bill with questions about why he was interested in pottery and whether Bill thought he might be homosexual. Bill defended himself by trying to ignore his father's myth-based and partially alcohol-induced questions, and by forgetting about pottery and sticking to soccer. But now, as the proud father of 14-year-old Alex, Bill confessed how hard he was finding it to deal with his son's newfound interest in painting and sculpting. Bill admitted that the memory he had about his father kept resurfacing, and that he was now becoming worried, ironically, that perhaps Alex was headed for many shame-filled years as a possibly less than fully masculine adolescent. Bill also admitted that he felt bitterly envious of Alex, since his son seemed so happy and carefree doing just the kinds of hands-on creative work that had once been forbidden to Bill. Because of his anger, Bill had been trying, painful though it was, to keep his distance from his son. "As much as I really want to be close to Alex, right now I just feel this incredible wall between us. I know he should be allowed to do whatever he wants, but I just want to scream at him whenever he brings home one of his sculptures or paintings. It seems like things are so easy for him, and sometimes I hear my father's words in my head and think, maybe if I don't do something, Alex is going to turn out to be effeminate. I feel like such a hypocrite. I know I should love my son for whoever he is." The poignancy of the story comes in the solution that Bill found for himself and for Alex. With a little bit of friendly encouragement from me and a lot of love and support from his wife, Bill decided to buy a potter's wheel and kiln and to enroll in an adult education course for beginning potters. He also decided to involve Alex in his learning process so that Alex could feel free in the afternoons after school to spend as much time as he wanted making pottery using the wheel and the kiln. Before long, father and son were spending many an evening in the family pottery basement, turning out a variety of team-produced ceramics. Now Bill has not only soothed much of the hurt about how his father treated him as a child, but also developed a well-deserved sense of pride about how he was able to overcome his own irrational feelings about Alex. Above all, he and his son have found a hobby at which they both excel, and one that they greatly enjoyed doing together. The Marketplace's Mistake. Of course, it's not only a father's internalized feelings that may hold him back from connecting emotionally with his son. Society's traditional expectations of men and the way many workplaces are still run can also often make it difficult for men to even find enough time and energy to be with their sons. Despite a father's best intentions, society sometimes makes it very difficult for a father to stay closely involved in raising his children. Workplace family programs continue to be primarily aimed at women. And when opportunities for choosing family over work are offered to men, they often demur for fear, based on real experience, that opting to use such family-friendly benefits will blacklist them for a promotion or raise. When my daughter Sarah was born, only 10 years ago, I was working for one of the seemingly more flexible institutions, a teaching hospital associated with Harvard Medical School, where at that time there was no paternity leave, in fact, no policy at all for new fathers. I remember my relief when, through the underground grapevine of male clinicians, I learned I could take sick time to be involved in my child's birth and early development. Indeed, in one recent study, it was found that men with MBAs who work just 2 fewer hours per week to help share in child-rearing duties get raises that are 20% lower than men who sacrifice their sons for work. Such society-determined systems discourage most men from taking the nurturing plunge and must be changed if we are to raise the type of healthy, loving boys we want for the next generation. Other external situational factors can also separate father and son. For instance, when the family model is less traditional, for example, when mom and dad have divorced and dad lives elsewhere, satisfying the yearnings between son and father can, of course, become even more complex. It has been estimated that for the children of baby boomers, 59% of their sons will live without their fathers for at least part of their childhoods. In 1990, more than 36% of all children were living apart from their fathers, and among those fathers who did not have custody of their children, a majority began to lose touch with their sons within 3 years after moving out of the home, sometimes abandoning them completely. In a study by the Census Bureau, it was reported that in 1994, over 16 million children were living with only the mother, and 40% of those kids hadn't seen their fathers in at least a year. Even within traditional, intact two-parent families, both fathers and sons complain about a lack of an